The first visual memory I have of Merce Cunningham is him alone on a stage in a blue leotard. It's the Cornish stage at Cornish Institute in September of 1977. It's a Cage-Cunningham dialogue, just the two of them, at the school in which they first met, when Cage was the accompanist for Bonnie Bird's dance classes and Cunningham was a student there. In 1977, the Cunningham Company and Cage came for a residency at Cornish. They were there for, I think, 2 weeks, and there was a week of performances. On, I believe it was Tuesday night, it was this dialogue. I had great anticipation, as at the time I was a graduate student studying Japanese art and architecture, and I was reading a lot of John Cage, Silence and A Year from Monday. And it was right after the Philadelphia Museum had done the Marcel Duchamp show. So I had the Kynaston McShine Andernon Court book and was spending a lot of time reading about Duchamp. So it was with great anticipation that I went to this performance to see these people who had met there many, many, many years before and had become so famous and influential. That was at a time that I feel there was a lot of interest in their work. Cunningham danced solo, and Cage was standing at a podium at stage left on the floor. So there we were in this very small auditorium. It seated maybe 100, 150 people. And John Cage was sitting there reading through Thoreau, which I had never heard before. I knew about the Mizostics, but I had never heard him read anything. And Cunningham came out, and he danced. I don't know whether it was an improvisation, although I doubt it based on the fact that this piece, How to Get Started, is about improvisation, which is very rare in their oeuvre. But Merce was up there in a blue leotard, which is so, for me, is something of a signature. I recently saw Suite for Five, and the man who was dancing Merce's part was wearing a blue leotard. So there was an overlay on my first memory of Merce Cunningham dancing on my first seeing of the Suite for Five as a piece. Lineages are extremely important in art. As a student of Japanese and Chinese art, I have studied many lineages where a teacher has a student follow what he does exactly until they become able to do the work themselves. This year, since it's 2011 and the last year of the Merce Cunningham Company Legacy Tour, there is a great deal of interest in the lineage of Merce Cunningham and how his dances came about. And next year will be the Cage centenary. So for me, there's a great deal of interest in going back and understanding what I have learned from John Cage and from Merce Cunningham. I hope to see one of the last performances at the Park Avenue Armory of the Cunningham Company doing events, which will be very much like the Merce Cunningham Memorial that I saw there. And I think that this will be a good opportunity for me to reflect on all the different lineages that I have been subject to. I just was talking to one of my clients at the Princeton East Asian Center and was offered the opportunity to edit a very eminent scholar in Japanese art history. I remember the first time I met him, I was introduced by Boyer Gonzalez, who was the subject of the first book I ever worked on, when he had a retrospective exhibition. He was a man who grew up in Woodstock, New York, where George Bellows was his baseball coach in Little League, and his father was Winslow Homer's fishing partner in Maine in the last days of Homer's life. So Boyer had grown up
which I had never heard
with
of
the artists.
I knew about the
and so it was extremely interesting for me to learn about how he trained.
And Cunningham came out.
One of my most important lineages is Elizabeth Bailey Willis, who was born in Boston in 1902. And I met her in the 1980s. She died at the age of 103 in the Seattle vicinity. And she's the only person I know who can say that when she was in high school, she went to the Boston Museum of Fine Arts and saw some things one year. And the next summer, she went back to Boston. And there were all these wonderful Indian paintings there, which she distinctly remembers, the first time Indian art had been displayed in Boston like that. It was the collection of Ananda Kentish Kumara Swami, whose collection had been bought and was now installed in the MFA. The Japanese verb hanashimawaru is a combination of to talk and to walk around.
I have studied many
Hanashimawaru is one of my favorite words in the world.
A student follow what he does.
It's a word I learned when I was studying Japanese in Seattle. And I found out as we got into our later studies that there were these wonderful compound verbs. Another favorite is yomi aseru. Yomi is the verb to read. Aseru, if I remember correctly, is the verb to fish. So yomi aseru means to read and fish at the same time. So I often read this way, where I will pick up a book or two, and I'll read a little bit, and I'll get another book, and I'll read a little bit, and it will remind me of something else. And so I'll go find it, and pretty soon I have a whole bag of fishes in my creel in the form of a stack of books next to me. And well, hanashimawaru, or to walk around and talk, or to talk around something, is a way of discourse that I think it's very well used to characterize a Japanese way of thinking. That is very different from the linear way that we in the United States often think. Takeo Doi, an eminent psychologist who used to talk about the Japanese mind, gave a lecture in Seattle where I saw him talk about how Americans, and he had a finger on his hand, talk in a straight line, and he traced this line as you go from point A to point B to point C.
And his father,
however, the Japanese, he said, generally did not do this. The Japanese would start at a point, and he put his finger in the middle of his palm, and then begin to walk around it, sort of unfolding as things went along. And he traced in his palm the spiral that went farther and farther out, and that was really something that was a way of talking about something, seen from different views, looking around it, and so forth.
She's the only person
I first began to think about this as a profound way when I heard a lecture on Japanese gardens, where the speaker, Richard McKinnon, did exactly that. He started in the middle of the topic of gardens, and he walked around and around and around, layering and layering. And when he finally finished, we were outside the garden looking in,
whose collection had been bought and was now installed in the MFA.
The Japanese sound dance. Last month, I went to Bard, to the Frank Gehry Hall, and to see something with great anticipation. The dance that they were doing at the end of the program of the Cunningham performance in this leg of their legacy tour was sound dance. First, there was Suite for Five, which I had seen in workshop at a Mondays for Mirth. Antic Me, which I'd actually seen last spring at the Joyce Theater, and then sound dance, which I had not seen since September of 1977,
the first time I ever saw the Cunningham performance performed over the course of a week. It was actually the second performance of the whole company, but it was an amazing thing to see. It was, I believe, the end of the program in 1977, and the dancers just exploded from the back curtain. And I will always remember, aurally and kinesthetically, the soundtrack for that dance, which is Tone Burst by David Tudor. I went years later and told him at a City Center performance in, about 1994, after a performance where he was sort of putting his things away, I said, "Excuse me, Mr. Tudor, I just wanted to tell you that I heard Tone Burst in 1977 in Seattle, and it completely changed the way I thought about electronic music." He gave a very gentle smile and said, "Thank you." And so I've always thought that was sort of a wonderful bookend to my hearing of Tone Burst. And then 2 weeks ago, well, maybe 3 weeks ago now, I actually heard Tone Burst, now called Untitled when it's reperformed, performed in a realization by John King. And it was astonishing to me, as I watched the dance and listened to the music, how much I really remembered having not heard it but once and so many years ago. There were sounds I recognized, there were sequences and building up of the music that I recognized, and I really remembered that it was very different the way he ended. One of the things that was so different was it was a two-channel performance in Seattle. There was a speaker on stage right and stage left, whereas at the Fisher Hall at Bard, there was sound all around us, and the way it moved and the way John King orchestrated that was truly phenomenal. But the thing that I really noticed was that it was not almost too loud and getting louder and louder, and at the very end, stopped. Resonance is something that has always fascinated me.
I went to Bard.
It's a very resonant word to see something that, for someone like me, who I think
the dance
is primarily
doing
oral,
at the end of
not
the
visual,
the Cunningham,
the sound of resonance is a very important one.
Was
sound
dance.
I hear it
first,
and
there
I also
feel
for
it.
Five. Which I had seen in
Gaston
Bachelard
in
the Poetics of Space,
Antony,
as an epistemology of
the poetic image,
spring,
which is based
the
on the sound
theater
of resonance.
And then
he talks about how,
which I had not
at least
seen
in translation,
September
a poetic
of
image is a salient
the first
on the
time
surface
I ever
of
the
poetic
saw
consciousness,
the Cunningham,
so
which then
performs,
goes out
over the course of a
and
week.
Rings.
It was
and
actually
a form
the
of resonance
of the whole
that then hits
company.
Other minds.
But it was an amazing
and of course,
thing
as we know
see.
From
it was
throwing multiple
the
pebbles
into
the water.
There will be different rings going
and
out from each
center
of
consciousness,
overlapping and forming interference
and
patterns in the form of waves.
Aurally and kinesthetically,
I learned a lot about resonance itself from Stuart Dempster. Stuart Dempster is a trombone player and didgeridoo player,
whom I first saw
in September 1977
at the Seattle Arena
after a
in the
very
first
performance
of the Cunningham residency.
Excuse me, Mr.
When they had an event,
I just wanted to tell
there
you
were three
that
musicians,
Tone Burst,
Taika Hisakosuke, David Tudor,
and
a completely some
man,
the way
that's what I know
I
now,
thought about
and there was some
music.
Man leaning over some strange
smile,
looking
said,
device that made some
and
kind
so
of
I've
long,
always thought
constant
was sort
noises.
Of a wonderful book
that was sort of a Z
shearing
and in black.
And
I now, 2 weeks
ago,
that it was
well, maybe
3 weeks
ago,
a didgeridoo
now,
made of sewer pipe, which is Stuart's favorite material
when it's
for a didgeridoo. He finds
even more than
the
John
pipes
King.
That he's found
and
in
it was
Australia.
Astonishing to me.
A sewer pipe
as
is a wonderful
the
dance.
And
listen
to the music.
After that,
how
I learned
I really
from
remember
in the Abbey of
having
Pop
not
Clermont.
But
from Stuart,
and
that
so
you could make
ago,
standing waves.
There were
and
sounds I recognized.
Perhaps
there were sequences
in a room like
of
this.
Building
in
up
fact,
of the music
when
that
I first sat at this desk and thinking
really
about how to get started,
it was very different.
I noticed
ended.
One of the things that was so different was it was a two-channel performance in Seattle.
There was
a speaker on stage right and stage
where,
left. Whereas at the Fisher Hall at Bard, there was sound all around us. And
way John King orchestrated that was truly phenomenal. But the thing that I really knew was that it was not almost too loud and getting louder and louder, and at the very end, stopped. Boop! Chehalis and Other Voices is the name of a song by Oregon that, when I first heard it in North Carolina, I had no idea what it meant, but it was a poetic title that always struck me. Only later, when driving often between Seattle and Portland, would I begin to discover that Chehalis was a town in the Olympic Peninsula, and on gray, rainy days that are so common in the Pacific Northwest, I could pretty much always count on the most beautiful, luminous oyster gray in the entire trip, either from Seattle to Portland, or Portland back to Seattle, a three-hour trip. Chehalis would be the place of the most beautiful light. If you take the Chehalis exit off I-5, you'll be very close to Centralia, where, in 1919, Merce Cunningham was born. So there's this wonderful Centralia-Chehalis axis in my own mind of this music and light and art. So I have come over the years to really enjoy the different overlays of this Olympic Peninsula, where you have towns named Hump Tulips, Moncliffe, and Aberdeen, which is a coastal town. Aberdeen may be one of the more important places in 20th century art in the United States. It's a little town that I went through once in my first trip around the peninsula, and I literally bought a postcard of the main intersection of town, which had the single stoplight. And I thought, what an amazing monument, the stoplight in Aberdeen on a postcard. Who would know that Robert Motherwell was born there in 1915, or in 1936, even Trisha Brown? Trisha Brown grew up in the woods near Aberdeen and learned to dance there. Her older brother was a good friend of somebody 2 years older than Trisha, the photographer Lee Friedlander, and in the Trisha Brown book I worked on, there's a picture of her brother taken from above the basketball goal, looking down on him as he makes a basket, taken by Friedlander. And then, in 1967, Aberdeen, Washington was the place where Kurt Cobain was born. So Cunningham, Brown, Motherwell, Cobain. There's an amazing lineage that doesn't even encompass Helmy or Brent Garris or any of the others who also have been on the Olympic Peninsula.
It was not almost too loud and getting louder and louder, and at the very end, stopped. Boop!
How to Get Started is the name of the song. I love the word oratory. That it's when I first heard it used in North Carolina, silence in the year for Monday, no idea what it meant. But it was often been applied to the that always struck me. Chance or improvisation to some drive music in the 60s between the and in the 50s. When I began to discover being here and how to get started, was a town thinking a lot about Cage and Cunningham recently. I've thought a lot about the difference of improvisation and spontaneity versus composition that comes in the chance to take an order, as is what I'm doing right now. I am not choosing what order to be read. I am not necessarily choosing all of the cards. However, once this is done, it will be frozen in a particular order.
If you take the Chehalis as many of Cage's and Cunningham's
you'll be very close to Centralia. It's very different from improvisation,
which for me has been a very natural thing to do.
So there's in high school, I did forensics, and did a lot of improvisation where you had literally of 1 minute to prepare a talk on a topic and art. And so extemporaneous,
I have come over the
where you were given 5 minutes to prepare
the different
a really good speech on a topic Olympic Peninsula, where you have towns named.
So improvisation in jazz and in Aberdeen
music and walking down the street has been a very important part of my life and seems very natural.
When I was studying a lot
of Zen
and Buddhism,
I went through
my college years.
My first trip,
I thought a lot about how,
and I literally bought
postcards
of the main
intersection from
China,
which had
the same stuff to me that
the way the Japanese,
what an amazing model
was spontaneous,
was what I called a certain well-planned spontaneity.
Robert Motherwell,
they created a choreographed ritual like the
in 1936,
where everything was known to a certain extent.
Trisha Brown grew up
that would then create in you and learn to
the possibility of an opening.
That
her older brother was a good
happened,
friend of somebody 2 years
to
be
aware of Trisha.
The photographer
that
in the years
since
the Trisha Brown book
I worked
on, their chance
there's a picture of her brother starting
taken from above the basketball hole.
The
looking down on him as a basket,
taken by
theater.
I've taken
that
farther
in 1967,
where improvisation,
Aberdeen,
which was distrusted
place
where
Kurt Cobain
here and Paxton
so
and
Cunningham
talking
Brown,
about how
the kinds of things they
Cobain
and how
there's an amazing
studio
which was so
different
compass
were very much
distrusted
in New York
or
of Brent
Getz
or any of the others.
Of course that
may
also
be
an East Coast
and West Coast thing, especially then.
But we hope it's different
louder,
now.
Louder
different
at the
now.
Very end.
One day, when working at the Henry Art Gallery
in
Seattle, probably in the mid-1980s, I got on the bus to go home, the number 71 bus, which went up University Avenue and took me up to 65th, where I went up a few blocks and got off and walked on one block and a half. I had in my pocket of my jacket a newspaper article that I had cut out to save for later. I sat down on a seat in the aisle on the right side of the bus, and the bus got crowded a stop or two after I was there, and I was reading a review of a Merce Cunningham show of his botanical drawings when I noticed the woman standing next to me was sort of leaning over and trying to read the article. And she said, "Excuse me, where did you get that?" And I said, "I cut it out of the New York Times. I don't know when it was a few weeks ago, but I've been saving it till I had a chance to read it. It's about a show of Merce Cunningham's botanical drawings." And she says, "Oh, I know he does drawings of plants. They're very lovely." And I said, "So what do you know about Merce Cunningham or whatever one says in such a circumstance?" And she went on to say that we went to the prom together. He was a senior, and I was a junior. He danced wonderfully, even then. So I gave her the article to read, and then she got off the bus, probably on U-Way, maybe where a dance studio was. There was a ballet studio up at about 50. And I remember very distinctly watching her walk down the bus with her light brown braid and her camel-colored jacket. And she got off the bus and she turned around afterwards and she smiled at me and waved. So I thought, wow, what an amazing thing. She went to the prom with Merce Cunningham. He was a year older than she was and he danced wonderfully even then. So I later, after having met Stuart Dempster and gotten a little more comfortable with the whole milieu, I decided one day I would write Mr. Cunningham, which I did. And several months later, he wrote me back. And he said, "Well, thank you very much for your letter and for the information. I don't remember," in quotes, "he was a senior and I was a junior, but I do remember going to the prom. I had a passion for dancing, even then." So here is this man who danced as long as he could, even on arthritic feet, dancing wonderfully as a high school senior in Centralia.
There was a cage in Cunningham Gallery residency at Cornish in August and September of 1977. I now know the dates because I just went to the John Cage Trust to see if they had any information. And I found that there was a press release in John Cage's correspondence and two letters back in my pocket between John Cage and Mel Strauss, who was the president of Cornish at the time.
I sat down on a
seat in the aisle with great anticipation and to what was going to be an astonishing week of performance.
And I was reading
on Sunday night there was an event in the Seattle
of his botanical
drawings. On Monday night there was nothing. Looking at the press release,
sort of
said that there was also an event in Tacoma. I now suspect that they did the event in Tacoma, which is about 30 minutes out of Seattle.
I don't know when it was.
That Monday
night.
On Tuesday night, if I remember correctly,
it's about a John Cage and Merce Cunningham dialogue. I know
on the
he
Cornish
does
stage.
Plants.
And the next
they're
night
very lovely.
Was
and
the
I
John
said,
Cage
so
concert,
how, what do you know
which was
Cunningham,
all music by John Cage, performed by the Cornish faculty
and she,
and
she went on to say,
that was a really amazing evening.
We went to the prom together.
There weren't that many
he was a senior, and I was a junior.
Because, of course, he was the most famous.
Even then.
One of the most famous people.
I gave her the article to read.
Where
and
he would
then
accompany us at a time
she got off the bus,
to start
probably on the on Gateway, maybe we're a dance studio.
And I will always remember going out of the
and I remember very distinctly watching her walk down
and going into
the
parking lot
brown
where there was an oval of cars
and
the, one of the radio.
She got off the bus and she turned
so
around.
There was John Cage standing in the dark. With
so
the headlights of the cars,
wow, what an amazing scene.
And there were musicians in different cars.
He was
and he was giving the times and he danced, and the different people in their different cars were following the instructions. And so there was
later,
a
after
random student sample
and
of radio
more
sound
with the
and
whole
noise coming all around the park.
I would write Mr. Cunningham, which I did.
There were then two performances
and several months
of proscenium acts in the Navy Theater.
Well,
being a
thank you very much for
and for the I was able only to go to
I don't remember.
So I decided to forego the
quotes.
The premieres.
He was a senior,
and I was a junior, which had a new
but I do remember
age, and going to the
scenario
by Murray,
I had
by
a passion for dancing.
Although
even
I was very happy to
so
see
here
all the
shows
and the Rauschenberg shows
as long as he
instead,
could. Even
I saw. The piece that made the biggest impression on me,
wonderful,
at me
as a high school,
and the name of it was Sound Dance.
There was a cage
in the 18th century residency. There was a Zen master in Japan named Hakuin. He was actually a really important teacher and a very, very wonderful painter and calligrapher. I first began to learn of him through art books, and then I subsequently have seen translations of his teaching, because this was one of the rare men in Japan, in the Zen, I looked at the various Zen temples, who was both a famous artist and a famous Zen master. Last spring, at the Japan Society, in the Hakuin show, I saw a calligraphy where he had brushed a saying by Dafwei Zhongguo, who was a 12th century Chinese monk. So this is a very typical kind of thing where a 12th century monk in China would say something.
It's about the show.
Perhaps as an admonition to a student, an 18th century teacher in Japan would brush a scroll and give it,
which was
perhaps as an inga or symbol of a kensho or realization experience,
that was
or perhaps given to a temple donor who had fixed the roof or gotten the genkan remade or whatever. So there was an exchange of teaching and through time. So here I was in the early 21st century looking at a scroll and from the 18th century which preserved a saying by a monk from the 12th century. And the calligraphy was really wonderful. The Hakuin show has several examples of famous Hakuin paintings that I've seen.
There was
of traditional Zen subjects or of phrases that Hakuin was especially known for.
her painting, there's a fantastic scroll of a monk's staff, which is actually a calligraphed sage. This is something that in almost anything you can read about or look for haka reading, you'll see one of these wonderful staffs with the calligraphy. There were other sayings that were rather new to me and were well translated by Stephen Addis, who was the translator and author of the book. And one of my favorite paintings in the world, I'd have to put it in the top 10, was there in two versions, because this is something typical in that school of painting. It's blind men crossing a bridge. And it was wonderful to be able to see the two different realizations of two men trying to cross a log bridge that actually goes off into the precipice. But the saying that Hakuin brush that made such an impact on me was this: contemplation in the midst of activity is 100 million times better than contemplation in stillness.